On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
You have this kind of asymmetrical warfare coming from a guy who's great at a soundbite, lousy at an answer.
So are you looking for your own billionaire?
Nope. No, I don't want my own billionaire. I'm going to raise the vast majority of the money.
Brace yourself, America, for what?
King Trump.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
Suspect said he was upset about Black Lives Matter. He said he was upset about the recent police shootings. The suspect said he was upset at white people. The suspect stated he wanted to kill white people, especially white officers. The suspect stated that we will eventually find the IEDs. The suspect stated he was not affiliated with any groups, and he stated that he did this alone.
Dallas Police Chief David Brown today describing the standoff with Micah Johnson. Johnson is believed to be the sniper who killed five police officers at a Dallas demonstration last night. He was eventually killed by police. Earlier this week, videos of two black men being shot and killed by cops in Baton Rouge in Minnesota went viral. It's been a week of violence and racial tension across the country. And amid all this, black police officers are in a delicate position. Charles Wilson is chairman of the National Association of Black Law Enforcement Officers and a retired police lieutenant. He joins me now. Welcome.
Hello.
Hi. Great to have you with us. Well, first, just give us your personal reaction to the news this week.
I'm sorry?
Please give us your personal reaction to the news this week.
And I'm having a bit of a problem hearing you, dear. But I believe you asked for my personal info. My name is Charles Wilson.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, your personal reaction to what happened this week.
I'm going to tell you an extreme sense of grief and despair. The two police shootings. In my mind, they were both senseless. And you know, I understand and recognize the strong sense of anger and frustration that people in the community have. These incidents happen seemingly just too often, and there's no sense of explanation. There's no sense of accountability being had for any of it. But in the same sense, in regards to the incident in Dallas, using the first two as a reason or excuse to openly assassinate law enforcement officers is not the way to go about getting justice in the community.
What has been the reaction amongst your colleagues to the killings of the officers? Are they afraid to go out now? Are they talking about added security?
You've now got people talking about where we used to ride single cars and patrol the community in that fashion. People are now riding doubles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people are now calling for backup a lot quicker.
How, as an African-American police officer, have you at times felt caught between being African-American and being a police officer?
That's a constant tightrope we walk. We have to balance that not only amongst our law enforcement peers, but amongst our fellows in the community as well.
Mm-hmm.
Our peers often ask, Are you a black man or are you a police officer? You know, because they all believe it's all blue. I'm sorry, it's not.
Do you feel that because you're African American, you police differently?
Oh, I know we do. There's no doubt whatsoever in my mind that we do. We seemingly have a much better rapport with the community. Most of us work in those communities that we grew up in. We work around people whom we've known for years. Some of them, yes, we've had to put in jail. You know, but it's we treat people differently. You know, we have a better understanding, I think, of what their issues are and what their concerns are, because we talk to them. We, you know, we go to the same churches they go to. We go to the same parties they go to. You know.
Yeah.
Our counterparts don't do that. They, you know, I've often told people, particularly where it came to recruiting, you know, if you want to truly reach out to people in the black community, go to their churches.
Mm-hmm.
You know, go to the gyms and community centers that we go to. That's where you're going to find your applicants.
When it comes to preventing officer-involved shootings, you know, often the decision to shoot comes in a split second, and often it's been shown in studies that there is latent racism that comes into play. Can you effectively combat racism on an individual level in police departments amongst the officers, or is it more realistic to focus on strategies that effectively put a wall between officers' biases and their actions?
Well, the first thing people have to understand is that there's a common sense method to dealing with police encounters.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? The first thing you do is if the officer asks you for identification of any sort, give it to him. Don't argue with him. You know, talk in a calm, even-handed manner. Don't automatically start cursing him out and telling him how you think it's racial profiling, you know, and how you're going to sue him and all this here kind of good stuff. You don't know enough about the law to tell him that. You know, now, I recognize that's not what people want to hear me say.
Yeah.
But,
well, I mean, that apparently in Minnesota, the man who was killed there, he did all that. He was complying. He was.
Yeah. And you can't account for idiots.
You know, meaning the police officer.
Yes.
Right.
You know, what my counterparts first have to understand and accept. The institution of policing is inherently biased against people of color and low income. It was designed this way. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
What everybody else must understand is that the profession of law enforcement has improved and been enhanced dramatically over the last 50 years. The problem is that those improvements and enhancements have not been amplified to the point where they are openly accepted and understood. You know, people in the community want to know what the police do, how we do it, and why we do it. And the police don't tell them jack.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a strong sense of confusion and misunderstanding.
On both sides.
Yes, on both sides.
Yeah.
You know, the police are not actively talking to people in the community. They look at the overriding issues of crime in the community and equate that to a perception of how people are in the community.
Well, I want to...
Perceptions are incorrect.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. That's Charles Wilson. He's chairman of the National Association of Black Law Enforcement Officers. He's also a retired police lieutenant. And protests were peaceful yesterday in Dallas before the shooting broke out. The police department there had been posting pictures of the demonstrations on Twitter, even of officers smiling alongside protesters. The department is well regarded for its relationship with the community it serves. In recent years, the Dallas PD has taken a community policing approach, and they credit that approach with a decrease in excessive force complaints and arrests. Community policing has been adopted in cities across the country, especially since President Obama formed a task force to push that approach following the death of Eric Garner in 2014. Joining us now is Albert Samaha. He is the criminal justice reporter for BuzzFeed News. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
We'll talk more a little bit about the Dallas Police Department and its approach.
Yes. So the Dallas Police Department has kind of emerged as a possible national model for kind of the progressive reforms a lot of folks are pushing for in police departments across the country. And it sort of traces back to when Police Chief David Brown took over in 2010. In the years since, the arrest rates have gone down, the excessive force complaints have gone down, and the number of police shootings have gone down. I think in 2009, the year before he took over, the department received 147 excessive force complaints, made 74,000 arrests. By 3-4 years later, that was down to like 61,000 arrests and 53 excessive force complaints. Mm. And it's all good.
Well, what do they do differently now?
So he made an effort to institute a new training protocols centered around de-escalation, where instructors will train police officers to the term they use is slowing down. So instead of immediately approaching a suspect, they'll kind of hold their ground. Instead of instantly yelling at a suspect, they'll speak calmly, try to build a rapport. And they've also kind of they double training hours and put more work into less than lethal force. They increased the amount of data they're taking, so they were able to see the amount of use of force they were using at a year-to-year level. But a lot of those things just sound kind of easy. I think the hard part, though, is instituting it into the culture of the department, and I think that's where Brown has succeeded.
And what about what our previous guest was talking about when he said that there's a lack of communication on both sides? Do the sides get together in Dallas?
So from what I've heard from my sources in Dallas, there's a pretty good relationship between, for example, the Black Lives Matter activists in the city and the police department. It's never going to be perfect in any city because there will always be tension. There will always be stories of people who did receive injustice at the hand of the police department. But relative to the rest of the country, it does seem like the Dallas Police Department makes a more concerted effort to maintain good ties with the community.
And there were definitely criticisms over the police department and how it was militarized in Ferguson during those protests. And last night, the Dallas PD, they weren't wearing body armor. They were, you know, and often marching alongside or you know, friendly with the protesters. Did that make them a target?
So that's sort of the tragedy here is that they were in kind of their summer short sleeve outfits, the same ones they would wear on any other day on patrol. The photos on their Twitter feed were showing them taking photos with protesters, intermingling with them. Maybe it did, maybe it didn't. It's hard to know what the perpetrators were thinking, but I think the fear a lot of folks have is that this will swing a pendulum back towards more police departments using the type of methods we saw in Ferguson. I think we're already starting to hear some police unions call for those type of militarizations and covering protests. But the fact was this wasn't the deaths weren't caused by the protests and by the police department working the protests. It was by something beyond that, by what it seems like is a group of lone wolves. So will it change things? Who knows? If we look back to December 2014, when the two NYPD officers were killed in their car, there were cops who were afraid of a lot of copycats, and there were activists who were afraid that the police reform movement would end. And neither of those things happened. Everything kind of reverted back to normal after a few months. That was not as big in scope or magnitude as this. So we'll see what happens in the near future. But, you know, there will not necessarily be a backlash. It'll be interesting to see how both sides play it out moving forward.
Right. Now, what about community policing? As I mentioned earlier, the president formed this task force to encourage communities, Dallas and others, to adopt this community policing. What's happened in other cities?
There are cities that are doing it well. There are cities that are not doing it well. I think the cities that have gotten good credit, in Richmond, California, has gotten some credit. Milwaukee has gotten some credit. Las Vegas has gotten some credit, and Dallas, of course. And then there are other cities like the LAPD where they have claimed to have promoted community policing for many years now, but only now is there kind of police commission saying, actually, you haven't been doing a good enough job. Let's remake these policies. And I think what it comes down to is, It's one thing to use the term community policing and to put that in the manual and the guidebook. It's another thing to establish a culture that interprets that guidebook and those policies in a way that actually implements the spirit of community policing.
And is it one size fits all? Do the techniques carry from one city to the next, or do they need to be individually tailored?
I do think they need to be individually tailored based on, you know, the community. Every community is different. Every community has its own particular set of converging factors that create its own dynamic. I think there's a set of standard protocols, a template that a lot of departments can fit. But we've also seen a lot of departments make attempts and not succeed. And whether that's a reflection of the leadership not instilling a new culture well enough, or a reflection of policies that just weren't a good enough fit, that's for, you know, social scientists and policymakers to debate over years. But certainly you got to think that it's about finding the right fit for the right community.
Yeah. Well, it has been talked about as a sort of panacea. But when we see things like the killings of Black men in their cars, is it enough? Is it, you know?
It's a good question. I mean, there are deep-rooted institutional problems with policing in the country. I think it starts with community policing, but kind of moves forward past that. It's also use of force policies. It's also training. It's also, you know, a lot of little factors, like, do you have officers who live in the city or out of the city? Do you have a diverse workforce? Do you have quotas installed? How are you training your officers to handle various types of interactions? There's a lot of different steps on the road to solving these deep-rooted problems that have kind of been established in police culture over the last several decades. These are only the early steps. For us to see the later steps, we first need to see how the earlier steps go.
Well, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Albert Samaha. He is criminal justice reporter for BuzzFeed News. And we'd like to hear from you. Have you seen policing evolve in your community? Tell us about it on Facebook or Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, we'll talk to a local activist and anti-gang leader about what's next here in Los Angeles for community policing. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Listen to KCRW's music stream, Eclectic 24, for hand-picked music around the clock. You can find all of KCRW's produced content on our app. Download for free at kcrw.com/apps.
You You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Former Los Angeles Police Chief Bill Bratton is credited with bringing a community policing approach to the LAPD, a department that, before his arrival back in 2002, had been notorious for its poor relations with the city's minority communities. Chief Charlie Beck has continued and expanded the community policing policy. At an LAPD graduation ceremony today, Chief Beck told new police recruits to have empathy for those they come into contact with. And he went on to say this.
This is not about black lives, not about brown lives, not about blue lives. This is about America. This is a country based on a promise that does not recognize a difference in the shades of humanity.
Skip Townsend leads Second Call, a gang intervention organization that works in South LA. He's been closely involved with the LAPD's efforts to improve its relations with people in that community. And he's back now with us. Hi, Skip.
Hey, how you doing, Madeline?
Fine, thank you. Well, earlier this week, as we all know now, two black men, Alton Sterling and Philando Castile, were shot and killed by officers. Now 12 police officers in Dallas have been shot, 5 are dead. The suspected shooter said he wanted to kill white people, in particular white police officers. What are you hearing from folks today?
There's a lot going on in the community, and a lot of it is rage. Matter of fact, most of it is rage, but a lot of it is empathy as well, to where no one should be harmed, no one should be murdered. You know, they're asking for a place of calm. How can we calmly resolve the issues that we're and challenges that we're going through?
Do you think the shootings of these officers in Dallas will damage the Black Lives Matter protest movement?
I don't think so at all. I think these are two separate issues. And when we talk about Black Lives Matters, I just want to be careful not to speak on this one group that started after Michael Brown's killing in Ferguson, because there's so many different organizations that have been working prior to that at you know, kind of reducing the violence and working with law enforcement, working with the community. So Black Lives Matters actually goes beyond the hashtag and one specific group. It's an entire movement inside of the United States.
But are you worried that there will be so much anger about these killings on the part of whites, I suppose, to put it bluntly, that that might damage the reputation of black protest movements?
I really don't think so. I don't think that any movement that brings about justice for black people could even be validated by someone who is non-black or by someone who is pro-police. I think the Black Lives Matter movement and the movement inside the United States about the rights of black people is only going to be validated by themselves, by each other. As a matter of fact, it's not even ever going to be equal to any on any level, you know. So it's sort of like the civil rights movement. What they're fighting against is the system, the justice system, that says that, you know, our lives don't matter. Black lives do not matter. So that's a fight that couldn't be validated by anyone who isn't black.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's seems to be a moment here where people are talking about coming together, or, you know, fearful that this will drive people further into their corners. Chief Beck today said, and this is a quote from him, "We have done what societies do when they're in trouble. We have separated. We have broken into tribes." And then he said, "We must move beyond that." Do you think that we're at that moment where we're sort of deciding where we're going to go?
I think that, yes, we are definitely at that moment. And I wanted to share, too, that there are a lot of people I spoke to that are empathetic about anyone losing their lives, whether it's they had arms, but the black men who were killed who were not fighting against the police, but actually didn't have the option. You know, they were killed. So people are empathetic with them, but they're also empathetic with the shooting that happened in Dallas. But when we start separating, it's because of words. So the police chief in Dallas said these were cowardly acts, that the officers didn't have the opportunity to defend themselves. And now we separate because of words. So we start thinking, well, neither did Alton, neither did Mr. Castile. Neither one of them had the opportunity to defend themselves as well. And then we go back to Michael Brown. We go back to Sandra Bland. We go back to Ezell Ford in Los Angeles. So there's so many people didn't have the opportunity to defend themselves. So when you call someone a coward, it kind of makes it like now it's going to be us against them.
Yeah.
But I just want to be careful when we use words, and I think that it was good what Chief Beck said in separation. That is it right there. We're dividing. We're separating. But we have to be mindful that no one should lose their life.
In the earlier segment, we heard about Dallas and its move toward community policing and how successful it's been in certain areas, especially when it comes to officer-involved shootings. Here in Los Angeles, as I said, we have been practicing community policing, and yet officer-involved shootings are the highest in the nation.
Yes, so that's the one area that LAPD doesn't work with intervention in the community on. So what has normally happened is when we talk about reducing violence and LAPD listens to the community and we have community forums when it's involving the uprise and homicides and shootings in South LA or even in East LA. But there isn't a process to dealing with the community and officer-involved shootings. A lot of times they give it to the Independent Review Board, which is also an investigating team that is picked by the mayor's office. So these are city officials monitoring city officials, and then at the same point they have no authority. So once their opinion comes up, Chief Beck can actually knock it down, as he's done certain
mm-hmm.
times. So
yeah.
We're feel disconnected on that. And there's situations where we see that black officers have been criminalized for their shooting, but white officers are given jobs at the desk. They're reassigned as opposed to some criminal form being filed against them. So,
right, and the DA hasn't pressed charges.
Yeah, and everyone's so unhappy with the DA and the fact that she won't press charges, on LAPD officers, the sheriff department, or highway patrol. So, you know, what you're doing, what's happening is it's feeding and fueling a society that says we're not a part of them. But we're actually both a part of the community, law enforcement and the community. And I'm happy, not that we're having people who have lost their lives, but I'm happy we're having this uncomfortable conversation because this is what's needed to rebuild the community. This is what's needed to build a relationship that we've never had. We have to sit and talk about these uncomfortable feelings that we just can't hide. We can't sweep under the rug.
So what do you think needs to happen? I know you're not in Los Angeles right now, but when you get back, what do you think needs to happen in terms of sitting down and talking with police officers in the wake of these shootings in Dallas?
Well, that's what needs to happen. We need to have a regular 101. We need to hash it out. We need to actually get mad and argue at the table. We need to have both sides come out. It's like food poisoning. The only way the healing process to start is to get it out the body. So we have to talk these issues out. And it has to be uncomfortable. And it has to be facilitated where say what you feel and feel what you say. Don't hold back because of your position. If there is a group or a certain behavior pattern you don't like, let's get it out. Let's talk about it. And once we get all that out, now we can start the healing process. But if we're bundling this stuff in, if we're harboring it in just to keep a job or a position or to keep a relationship with one individual from law enforcement or one individual from the community, then we won't never start healing. We'll just be covering it up again.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with us today, Skip.
Yes, appreciate it.
That's Skip Townsend. He leads Second Call. It's a gang intervention organization in South LA. And we want to hear from you. What kinds of conversations are you having with friends and family about all of this, about this week and all the shootings? Give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can weigh in on Facebook at KCRW Press Play. Coming up on the program, we'll give you a mental health break from this grim news. We'll go to our film critics for reviews of the latest releases, including The Secret Life of Pets.
They're willing to kill animals. They are willing to have dancing hot dogs get eaten in half, and then the bottom's half still keeps dancing.
Movies, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Check out KCRW's all news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. I know a lot of people are going to need some escapism this weekend. If you're escaping at the movies, we have reviews of new releases. Roth Cornett is senior editor at HitFix.
Hello.
Hi. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And Amy Nicholson, chief film critic for MTV News and host of the movie podcast Skill Set. Welcome back, Amy.
Hi.
Let's start with something truly escapist. The Secret Life of Pets. It's an animated feature about what our pets are doing when we're not around.
Katie brought home a new dog from the pound.
She said he's my brother. I don't want a brother. And I don't even have a bed now. I'm sleeping on the floor like a dog.
Why would Katie do this to me?
Because she's a dog person, Max. And dog people do weird, inexplicable things. Like, they get dogs instead of cats.
All right, Amy, that's a Louis C.K., right, as the dog?
That is Louis C.K. as the dog, Max, who has been forced to take on an adopted brother. I have to say this right off the top about The Secret Life of Pets. When you're a film critic and you spend your life in public telling people what you do, they say, oh, I can't wait to see. This has been the number one movie that everyone random in my life has wanted to see all summer. Uber drivers, facialists, they all want to know about The Secret Life
Why?
Of Pets.
Why? Because it's Toy Story with pets?
I mean, that's a pretty good reason. Like, yeah. I have to say this also up front. The Secret Life of Pets is slightly anti-cat.
It's pretty anti-cat.
It's pretty anti-cat.
Roth, are you a cat person or a dog person?
I love them both, actually. I really, truly love all animals. This should have sort of checked all the boxes for me. What are animals doing when we're not there? I wonder these things. I really do. I think we all do, which is why they made this movie.
And what did you think?
It's funny because if we look at two of the other huge animated films this summer, Dory and Zootopia, those films, I think, really have something to say. They actually have pretty richly drawn characters, especially Zootopia, and they have something to say for families. Dory is sort of about, you know, people with limitations and the gifts that are found within, and Zootopia is challenging your preconceived notions. Neither one is a perfect metaphor, but they're there. There's really not a lot of there in terms of The Secret Life of Pets. It's exactly what it looks like on paper. It is a riff on Toy Story that is not as well done. The characters are not as richly drawn. The best character, or the most interesting one, is Kevin Hart's psychotic bunny, who is kind of amazing. Mm. Like, I would like to see that film.
He screams things like, death comes to Brooklyn, like he actually means it. It isn't cute. It isn't cute. You're a little scared.
Now, maybe okay, so I'm... we know who's going to star in the sequel.
Maybe I'm a bad person, but I liked this better than Finding Dory because it has this anarchic Muppet show quality to it. It's like Looney Tunes cartoons where they're shooting each other with cannons. Yeah, this is crazy. It's mean. It's unrepentant. It's very dark at times.
Is it funny?
I thought it was hilarious. But, I mean, a lot of this humor comes from the fact that they're willing to kill people or kill animals. They are willing to have dancing hot dogs get eaten in half and then the bottom half still keeps dancing. I mean, this is a movie with almost no kindness muffling it up like I felt like Dory did. With Dory, I felt like it was telling me how to feel all the time.
Mm.
The Secret Life of Pets lets you off the leash, and I ended up liking it a lot more.
Lets you off the leash. Okay, let's talk about another comedy, a bro-y raunch fest called Mike and Dave Need Wedding Dates.
Mom and Dad, what's going on here?
Over the years at our family gathering, you two show up and you ruin it. I want you to bring a date to your sister's wedding. We don't want you showing up stag and riling each other up.
We don't rile each other up.
We never get riled up.
So I guess they get a little riled up, Roth.
They do. They get wildly riled up, as you can hear. But it's actually more the women in this film that get riled up than the guys. They're there to sort of out-raunch them, which is fun.
And so they find their dates, and they're played by Anna Kendrick and Aubrey Plaza.
Mm-hmm. And you know what's funny is that, speaking of riffing off previous movies, this one's really riffing off Wedding Crashers. It even talks about Wedding Crashers in the movie. And a lot of people love that as a guilty pleasure. This is a lesser copy. It's not as funny. It's not as tight. There's some sweetness there, which is nice. And this is a really strong cast, which is, I think, what saves it. And what I really like about it is that, I wouldn't highly recommend this film necessarily for you to go spend your money on this weekend. But if you were to see it, what's nice about it is that the women are not just indulgent accessories, which is what you see so many times in these wedding comedies. They're allowed to have their own antics and their own foibles. They're very imperfect characters. it just doesn't quite nail the landing.
Mm. Yeah, I liked watching the women in this go absolutely mm-hmm. nuts. Especially you get to see Aubrey Plaza play against type. You know, she's usually this droll, sarcastic, doesn't care about anything in the world girl. And here she's crazy, drunk, and yelling, mm-hmm. causing trouble, being the center of attention. And that was really funny. But to me, the standout was actually an actress who wasn't even on my radar.
Yes, I know.
Are we talking about the same one?
Yes, we are.
Sugar Lynn Beard?
Amazing.
She plays
she's
the bride.
So good. The sister.
The sister. She's a 4'11" blonde Canadian, and she is amazing. She shows up on the scene with this tiny doll voice, and you're immediately kind of on guard because of wedding movies like this. Like, oh, this is the adorable bride. Here we go. But her character is absolutely mental and fun and in its own way.
Yeah.
I walked out of this movie IMDBing her. I had no idea who she was.
She was the standout for me, too. And that character was actually the standout for me, too, because I think that with Anna Kendrick and Aubrey Plaza, they were really pointedly playing against type. Anna Kendrick was not that bright in this movie, and she's wildly smart in reality. But Jeannie, who is the sister, is such a standout because she could have been a shrill stereotype. But you find yourself aligning with the characters, rooting for her to have a good wedding just because she is so funny and so charming and so totally relatable.
And the guy who plays her fiancé plays Richard, I think, in
yes.
Veep. He's great in Veep. Is he great in this?
He's great in everything. Yeah. I think he's an incredible comedian, just sort of, he's such a standout in Veep. And I think he doesn't have to do much to do a lot yeah. as a comedian.
Okay, let's move on to Captain Fantastic. This is a movie about a family living off the grid, way off the grid in Oregon, and what happens when they come back to civilization.
Mom needs to be in the hospital right now.
But you said hospitals are only a great place to go if you're a healthy person and you want to die.
You said Americans are undereducated and overmedicated.
All of those things are true, but Mom does not have enough of the neurotransmitter serotonin to conduct electrical signals in her brain.
Exactly when is Mom coming back?
That's what I'm going to go find out.
Okay, that's Viggo Mortensen. He's the patriarch of a pack of kids. Mom doesn't come back. We're not really spoiling it. And off they go on their adventure in the real world.
Yeah, Viggo Mortensen plays this leftist who's living in the woods with his 6 kids and trying to raise what he calls, quote, philosopher kings, kids who can kill their own deer, bathe in its blood, eat raw hearts, mountain climb with almost no equipment, and then at the same time go home at night and read Guns, Germs, and Steel and talk about Maoism and quantum physics. And this movie lets you get into this world and think, you know, he's doing it kind of right. This looks brutal.
Yeah, I could do that.
Yeah,
easily.
Why not? I mean, the 4-year-old in this movie knows more about the Bill of Rights than I think I would be able to say off the top of my head. But right when you think you're sucked into how this works, they are forced to leave the forest and go on a road trip to go visit their mother's family. And all of a sudden, you kind of get the sense of who Viggo Mortensen's character really is, that he is a guy who maybe is pretty obnoxious to be around and doesn't necessarily have the best perspective on what's right for his kids. And so the film starts getting into this war between should these kids be raised in civilization or should they be raised in the woods the way that they are. And the director, Matt Ross, makes pretty solid points on both ends, I felt like, even if he's not quite sure how to wrap it all up at the end.
Mm. Yeah, I saw this too. I saw it at Sundance, and I found it a bit sanctimonious, a bit siding too much on the living off the grid side as, you know, very virtuous, and we live in this corrupt, civilized world where kids are just zoning out on computers.
It definitely is not that kind of civilization when you meet the kids of it. You know, if they look at the kids their age, who this movie makes them dumb, ignorant,
right,
playing video games all the time.
Right, and the 5-year-old recites the Bill of Rights, and the other ones, they can't.
Yeah, the other one's like, a Bill of what?
Yeah. Let me get back to my Game Boy. Yeah.
You're right. It is definitely a little bit condescending, but it does score the points of these kids are covered in bruises. And are they even able to communicate with like kind? It's almost like putting 2 pets into the same apartment, to bring it back to our first movie. And they just don't even understand that they're the same species.
Oh, I was just curious why they had to bathe in the blood, if that was a ritualistic aspect.
It is one of those things.
It's also very moisturizing.
All right. Finally today, a documentary about a legendary TV writer and producer. His name is Norman Lear. It's called Norman Lear, Just Another Version of You.
Television can be broken into 2 parts, before Norman and after Norman.
This is a period of time where we were at our greatest change socially. Mainstream television was one of the last things to jump. And the first person to force it over that hill was Norman.
All in the Family was the greatest.
Do you have a quick answer for the people who say the show reinforces bigotry?
Yes, my
beginning?
Quick answer is no.
Norman Lear in his 90s now.
Yeah.
And sharp as a tack. Yeah. It's crazy.
So this is basically a victory lap for him, this movie?
Yes.
I mean, it's remarkable. It's really funny because my dad worked in television. So even when I was growing up, Norman Lear was kind of mythologized for me. But I saw it with a colleague at Sundance who had no idea who he was.
Really? And
which is interesting. But we were both equally taken. For me, it was watching the unfolding of this story that I already knew. Mm-hmm. But it plays with style, and he's a humanist, right? It means right there in the title, just another version of you. I'm not special. We're all the same. But I think if you look at his work, that reflects that, because he was bringing characters to life that he didn't necessarily relate to. Archie Bunker isn't a character that Norman Lear would relate to, but he's not making fun of him either. He's not a caricature. He's a human being. And I think that what's different about what we do today in media when we want to address social issues is that it becomes so satirical that it's no longer human.
Here's my question for you. Who has the longer lasting influence, Norman Lear or Aaron Spelling?
Norman Lear, period, the end forever. No,
I mean,
yeah,
who you want to have the most last.
I believe it's Norman Lear. I really do. I honestly do. Because, I mean, look, we've talked about a couple of guilty pleasure films. They're fine. Guilty pleasure television is also fine. But it doesn't leave an impact in the sense that we're not going to be watching a documentary about Aaron Spelling and talking about him with reverence, I don't think.
I'll bet you $5 we might.
Oh, Amy, why do you hurt me?
Well, we are watching the Kardashians. So.
Oh, just stop depressing me.
Okay, sorry about that.
I mean, that's one of the things that this film does highlight very well is that, you know, this medium is a great place to address issues and we're not doing it very well at the moment.
Right, and this was a particular moment where you had All in the Family, the Jeffersons, you had Maude with that famous abortion episode.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, they were tackling socially relevant issues.
And fearlessly, too. Yeah. And the other thing that the film does that I think you would like, Amy, and I'm going to wager a guess here, is that it doesn't necessarily say that he did it perfectly, right? Like, being a humanist doesn't mean that you're perfect. And it doesn't mean that you understand other human beings perfectly. So when he was doing things like the Jeffersons, it wasn't necessarily that he was landing it every moment, right? But he was trying. He was trying to understand the world around him. And I think that anybody deserves credit for that.
Well, I want to thank you both very much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you.
Some good movies to see. Amy Nicholson is chief film critic for MTV News, and she's the host of the movie podcast Skillset. Roth Cornett is senior editor at HitFix. Coming up, more movies. Outfest began last night. We'll talk about what you should see with Alonzo Duraldi. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Listen to the Rhythm Planet podcast to explore music from all corners of the globe. Brazilian, European, African, and tropical Latin. Rhythm Planet is a state of mind. Listen at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet or on KCRW's app.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Outfest, LA's LGBTQ film festival, opened last night with a gala screening of The Intervention. That's a film about friends who go on a trip to break up a marriage.
I think we should do it tonight.
We shouldn't even be doing this in the first place.
There's no way they could be that bad.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to this all week long.
It's done, okay?
Hey! Outfest has come a long way since it began in 1982 as the Gay and Lesbian Media Festival and Conference. To talk about this year's festival and films, I'm joined by Alonzo Duraldi. He is chief programmer at Outfest, as well as chief film critic for The Wrap. He's co-host of the movie podcast Linoleum Knife and one of our regular film reviewers here on Press Play. Hi, Alonzo.
Hi, Madeline.
Oh, that's a long resume there you have. But anyway, so I imagine at the gala last night, the tragedy in Orlando came up. Is that right?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a thing that's sort of hanging over us all in the community right now, and I think we're still sort of getting our bearings, but we're kind of looking at an opportunity here where we can come together as a community and talk about our issues and tell our stories and allow ourselves to experience some joy in the communal experience. And so Wilson Cruz came out and gave a very moving speech at the beginning of the evening. He lost a relative in the shooting, but he also encouraged us to keep telling those stories and to particularly, I think, specifically make sure that the stories of LGBT people of color not get lost, and that the 49 people that we lost in Orlando, you know, continue to reverberate and to have their life stories shared with others.
So the world has really changed since 1982 for LGBTQ people. And how is that reflected in the festival's lineup?
Well, you know, what Outfest has always been about telling our stories, and the belief that in telling our stories, we change the world and we change the way that people perceive us. I mean, when the discussion was happening in the last few years about same-sex marriage and it becoming, you know, accepted around the country, you had Joe Biden saying that, you know, Will and Grace brought him around on sort of understanding gay issues and feeling like he, you know, he had gay people close to him. And, you know, when you think about the people who watched, you know, Pedro Zamora on the Real World on MTV, and seeing him battle AIDS and marry his partner and stand up for LGBT rights, you know, the media has a strong influence on people. You know, when people watch movies and they watch television, they learn how to exist in the world. They learn how to date and how to make friends and how to eat and all those things that we pick up, you know, from the cues that we get. And so I think when you are exposed to stories of people who maybe have different lives than yours or who have different ways of expressing themselves, it's a way to create empathy. It's a way to create understanding. And we believe in the power of storytelling. And that's really what Outfest does.
So you're hoping straight people go?
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. The doors are wide open. We do not discriminate.
Okay. Because in the intro, it says, take a chance on a movie that doesn't match your letter in the LGBTQ alphabet soup. So who are you talking to there?
Well, I mean, that's obviously to our core audience, you know, the people who do identify as LGBTQ. And every year we try to encourage people, you know, if you are a white gay man, see a movie about Asian lesbians. You know, if you are a black lesbian, see a movie about a white trans teenager. You know, I mean, we all have different stories to tell, and we can all learn a lot from each other.
Okay, well, let's talk about some of your favorite films in the fest this year. And let's begin with Kiki. That's a documentary about a subculture called the Kiki scene. First of all, what's the Kiki scene?
The Kiki scene is kind of the contemporary outgrowth of the ball scene that we all got to know very well from the documentary Paris is Burning. It's sort of a contemporary outgrowth, and it operates under the same premises in a lot of way in terms of it's performance based, and it is people who are kind of forming these houses, these communities, these surrogate families amongst themselves. And this is a really exciting and vibrant film. It won awards this year at Sundance in Berlin. We're thrilled to be bringing it to Los Angeles for the first time. And you really get a sense of the communities that are being built here. These are people who are participating in these voguing competitions who are of every sort of sexual and gender stripe imaginable. And they really come together and create these families that give them the support they need to sort of survive in the world. And the filmmaker is Scandinavian, but she worked very closely with the subjects of the movie. So they were very much the co-producers. They were very much involved in the telling of their own story. So it's not necessarily just, you know, an outsider's perspective. And we're very excited about the fact that a lot of the participants of the film are going to be at the Ford Theater, the beautifully newly refurbished Ford Theater, where we'll be screening the film. And they will be holding voguing tutorials for the audience beforehand.
Oh, my gosh. When is that?
That is going to be Thursday night, the 14th.
Okay. Let's talk about another documentary. We have a clip of tape for this one. It's called Women, He's Undressed. It's about costume designer Ori Kelly.
He was a master of silhouette and of color.
The man put out 285 films.
It is that adventuresome Australian spirit.
The winner is Ori Kelly.
Okay, tell us more about Ori Kelly. I had never heard of him.
You are fully versed in the work of Ori Kelly, whether you know it or not. He was under contract for Warner Brothers for decades. So he dressed Bette Davis in most of her great films of that era, including the legendary red dress from Jezebel, which was, of course, really black because it was a black and white movie. He dressed Ingrid Bergman for Casablanca. He came up with all of those insanely wonderful Rosalind Russell ensembles for Anti-Mame. He dressed Marilyn Monroe and Tony Curtis and Jack Lemmon for Some Like It Hot. He's a Hollywood legend. And, you know, he was a kid from Australia who came to the United States to seek his fortune and first landed in New York, where his boyfriend was a young Cary Grant.
Oh, really?
So it's an amazing story. And the director is Gillian Armstrong, who's one of my favorite filmmakers. You probably know her from the 1994 remake of Little Women and My Brilliant Career. And she very, very deftly mixes, the footage, obviously, of the classic movies that he designed these costumes for, with these great interviews with people like Jane Fonda, who worked with him, with Deborah Landis, who's a real costuming expert. And then there's an actor playing Ori Kelly kind of narrating his own story along the way. And if you are a fan of old Hollywood and certainly of old Hollywood costumes, this is a must-see movie.
Okay, and when is it showing?
That's going to be this Saturday, the 9th, at 1:30 at the Directors Guild.
Okay, finally, let's talk about the closing night film, Other People. It's about a struggling comedy writer who returns home to Sacramento to care for his dying mother. Molly Shannon plays the mom. Here's a clip.
Here's a fun topic. Cremation.
Oh. I'm not gonna, we talked about this.
I know we talked about it. I just wanna.
I'm not gonna be burned up, okay? How would you like it if somebody set you on fire? No, thank you.
Well, it's not like they light you, you know.
I don't like camping and I don't like fires and I don't wanna be personally lit on fire. I wanna be frozen. Do they have that as an option?
Wow. Dark humor right there. Tell us about this movie.
Yeah. And the movie strikes a real balance between the comic and the tragic. This is the directorial debut from a Saturday Night Live writer, and it's very autobiographical. Jesse Plemons plays the Molly Shannon's son there, and you know him from Fargo and Breaking Bad. He's a really fascinating rising young actor. And Molly Shannon just knocks it out of the park. This is such an extraordinary performance for her, and she just hits all of the comedic and dramatic notes. We're really excited about this as our closing night film. We have moved it from the Ford to the Ace Hotel downtown to accommodate more seating. And we're delighted that the after party for the closing night film will be held at the beautifully newly renovated Clifton's Cafeteria. So it's going to be a pretty swell evening.
Okay, so that is Sunday the 17th, right?
Correct.
All right. And if people want to find out more, they can just go to the Outfest website.
Outfest.org. It's got all the information. And we, of course, if you are not able to get tickets, something online because it's that day or whatever, show up at the venue, get there 45 minutes, an hour early. We seat so many people off the will call line. So don't be discouraged. Don't think that something is sold out. You've always got a chance to get in.
All right, Alonzo, thank you so much. Have fun.
Thank you.
That's Alonzo Duralde. He is senior programmer at Outfest. And Jolie Myers is here now with the listener feedback. Hi there.
Hello. And I want to go back to some of the stuff that we talked to at the beginning of the show, some of the craziness that's going on this week. And we had a really interesting voicemail from a teacher named Angie. She works in West LA, and she is teaching a summer school course on world civilization. She took a break from the regular curriculum to talk to her students about what's going on, and here's what she had to say.
Just wanted to say that as an educator with a diverse classroom, it is really, really hard for white students to have this conversation about race, and it is an issue that I'm always trying to find better ways to have the conversation. But it's really difficult.
She says that it's even hard for her, even though she's willing to do it, and she hopes other teachers give it a try as well.
All right. Thank you very much, Jolie Myers. Hope you all have great conversations this weekend, that you have a peaceful weekend, and I'll see you on Monday.
Support for Press Play comes from the Kane Foundation, Rick and Suzanne Kane, and Jenny, Maggie, and Sari Kane.